Welcome back, everyone, to Dissecting Popular IT Nerds. I'm your host, Doug Kameen, and today I'm talking with Paul Falby, Director of IT at Cassens Transport in Edwardsville, Illinois. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Hey, thank you. Nice to be here.
Yeah. So we're talking about pronouncing last names before we got on the recording here. And everybody has, this is always one of those big things that happens with, you get somebody in their name, and then you have to spend a minute looking at it to be like, how do I pronounce this? Is it going to be some interesting pronunciation or not?
We say, at least I say it, my last name is Falby. You don't know how many mails I get to Fable and Talby and everything else. So I'm so used to, like, my brother says our name different. He says Falby, you know, and mm-hmm. I say Falby, you know. Most of us in the family say Falby with more of a higher A or whatever. And it's just interesting. And like I said, it gets to where, you know, I'm getting older and I don't care anymore. Somebody says Fable or something like that, you're not going to aggravate me. You know,
So my best friend, he's from Serbia, and his last name is spelled, I'm going to spell it first, and then I'll go through how it's actually pronounced. Milasinovic. So this is not how it's actually pronounced. Milasinovic is how it reads. Mm-hmm. Absolutely not how it's pronounced. Milosinovic, right? You would get that, right? Everybody would get that, right? So, <Yeah. laughs> you know, I mean, I'm Doug Kameen, but everybody wants to say my name is Kamen. I will randomly run into people who will be like, oh, hey, Mr. Kameen. And I'll be like, wait a minute, how'd you know to say my name right? Like, it's like a thing when they actually know. And I'm always in the back of my mind, I'm convinced, like, depending on where it happens, if it's because, like, their hospitality system or something has noted that, you know, like when I go stay at a hotel and they're like, oh, welcome, Mr. Kameen. And I'm like, did Hilton somewhere put in the system that, like, it's pronounced this way so that they can impress me when I show up?
I bet you they do that kind of stuff. And if you are great, you're right, how names can be really different than what they're spelt or anything. When I was growing up, down the street was a man, and he had sons that I played with from Lithuania.
Mm-hmm.
We said his name was Gribinis. Mm-hmm. And that's what, but there would be, if you'd go to, we used to call them their Lithuanian luau's, you know, their parties. And
oh, that sounds fun.
And some of the people would be calling him Mr. Rabinus.
Mm.
They would, you know, because we said Gribinis because his name started with the last name started with a G.
Mm-hmm.
But people would call him Rabinus. They just dropped the G and do it that way. It was crazy. And those Lithuanians, they were something else too.
They know how to party, right?
Well, yes, they did. We lived about a quarter mile away, and you could hear the accordions in the background and them singing and stuff because they were drinking alcohol and stuff like that. It was fun.
Oh, man. Those types of memories. That's great stuff right there. This is one of the challenges of these are very, we'll call them high class problems, but living in America with all these different people who have all these different names and from all these different cultures, and how does one culture pronounce it versus another? When did it change? You know, a lot of our names have been Americanized over the years, and as our families have lived here for successive generations and stuff like that. So, yeah, that's just it's always a crapshoot whenever you start looking at somebody's name. But we're here to talk about you and leadership and IT leadership in particular. So right. I'm just going to point out, you have a long career at Cassens. This is not, this isn't like a new role for you, if you will. Yep. I mean, you've been there a long time. Can you tell us a little bit about this? This is going to be great to talk about for somebody who's really spent a lion's share, almost all of a career in one spot.
Well, the Cassens family is just a wonderful family. They really are. You know, this is a family owned business. So titles here aren't that big of a deal, you know, because I'm never going to be like the president of Cassens because, you know, there's family members and stuff like that. And Yeah, that's good. And but they are wonderful to work for. They're very worried, you know, about their employees and stuff and the benefits and such like that. So it's the balance between, you know, between work and home life is just been great. So there's never, you know, there's been, I, you know, I had kids later on in life, so I wanted to be able to be to their ball games and coach their ball games and such. So Cassin's was a really good fit for me that, you know, I could be at home and go and run a 5 o'clock practice in the afternoon and such like that. So that's why, you know, like I said, great people to work with and, you know, that kind of situation. That's why I've been here this long. And a lot of, we got the trucking industry sometimes gets a bad rap for they don't think it's very sophisticated, but trucking is actually, it's a lot of, especially in ours, we move cars.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like the grocery business where it's a high revenue, low profit margin business. Mm-hmm. So you're always scratching to figure out how to save a little money.
Yep.
So you're always looking into, you know, we've been doing EDI as long as I've been here since 1991. It was over like 1,200 baud modems back then.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you know, we did a study years ago that we talked to our main customers, which are the Chryslers, the GM, the Fords, 40 different ways sometimes. And it's like sometimes we send the same data to them in different formats. And it's just, you just have to adapt and figure out what tools to use to do it and such like that. So it's been really great. You know, it's just the other day I was looking at a Perl script I wrote back in 92 or 93, and I could see some, and then I saw that some code in there. I was like, yep, I put that in for year 2000. Yeah. And there, like, we could build something in the 19th century and our 20th century. And, you know, so it's something that had to put a 19 in front of it. And when they pay it, it might have had to put a 20 in there because they didn't send the century in the format. And that's the way they still do it. If you can believe that, they never have changed their fee to us from this manufacturer that they don't even tell you what century you're in, you know.
Mm-hmm. So you're your own Y2K resolution operation too.
Yeah, you know, if I stay, you know, working long enough, I'm going to be working, I'll have worked through Y2K and the seconds, the epoch thing. So which is looming. I forget, is it 2034 or 2035?
When is the epoch? It's about consulting the internet, that series of tubes to figure it out. Is this 2038?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. 2038. Yeah. You know, conceivably, I could still be working then. It'll be something. I think that one will actually could be worse than Y2K. We prepared everything, and you know, it was, you know, for Y2K. I remember driving up here. I live about 10 miles away. Almost got wiped out by a deer walking across the road right in front of me before I got here. But yeah, we got in here, you know, after midnight and went around to everything. Everything was working good and went back home again. But the epoch thing, I think, could be a little more serious, especially with all this IoT stuff. If they're not building 64-bit, you know, making sure that they're doing 64-bit operating systems, it might be a little more problematic.
Mm-hmm. So, on the leadership front, 33 years so far at Cassin's, you know, you mentioned it's a great company, great family company to work for. You know, knowing that, you know, the family runs the business, so that's not going to be your future there, but you still get to be a leader to a lot of other folks in the organization. I mean, the Cassin's not a small company. I did some cheating and homework. I looked it up. You got sites all across the northern U.S., so this is a pretty big, sophisticated operation, lots of employees. There's staff that are looking to you, staff on your team. How have you led teams? I'll be more specific than that. You've been there 33 years. So my question, I think, is first, what traits have you really taken from working in a family business that you think are the most important for leadership?
Getting to know your employees. It's, you know, there's management is a lot of getting, you know, like you got to set a expectation level. And but on a smaller team, at the same time, there's a lot of camaraderie. You know, you end up going out for a drink or two, especially when you're younger and stuff, with everybody. And even though you got to get into the people, so you get a lot of bonds between the people. But then at the same time, you need to let them know that, you know, when you go out that front door, we're on the same level. We're friends or whatever. But when we come inside, work is work. Out, you know, play is play. You know, just because I may play softball with you, that doesn't mean you can get away with X or Y or Z. You know, work is work. Friendship outside is friendship outside. That's what I've always tried to impress on people. And, you know, as long as you set that out and you're consistent with it across everybody, you don't have too much problems. You know, you got to listen, and you got to listen to everybody, even, you know, no matter if you don't know, because, you know, you might miss something. You might think, oh, this person never has any good ideas, and you don't want to listen to the other idea. Well, you need to, because, you know, inspiration comes from everywhere, you know. So sometimes, you know, that one time that person has the great idea might be the biggest thing to do, you know, or the best thing to do. So you got to be listening, you know, set your levels of what is good and what is not, and stick with it. And I really think, and getting to know the people is important, you know, to try to know their husband's name, try to know their kids' names and stuff like that. Now, like I said, Cassens is a big place, big company, but, you know, in our IT, it's not so big that you can't know it. You know, now this formula may not work for everybody, but, you know, I've been in charge of different people ever since I've been 17 years old, and basically treat everybody like you want to be treated and get to know everybody and have your level set has seemed to work for, you know, I don't care if it's, you know, when I worked in the bakery and was on the cleanup crew, led the cleanup crew, or, you know, in college when you ran the tutoring department, or Cassens, or running a baseball team, or running a men's softball team, which can really be something. As long as you treat everybody with respect and stuff like that, you know, the easiest thing all the time is to rule autocratically. To be in charge and listen to other people's opinions and do that is a heck of a lot harder, but it has a lot of benefits, because it just seems that people are more cohesive that way.
Attention all of my IT leaders who don't know a lot about telecom. Many of you are still managing a pile of junk and you've inherited a telecom silo. I call it a telecom time bomb. Many of us are ignoring it because the enormity of tasks surrounding a phone system replacement is overwhelming, and there's a constant barrage of direct sales reps trying to get you into a new UCaaS system today. And the whole process ends up being filled with an unforeseen comedy of errors. However, for those of you tackling such a task, you must answer, number one, are you going to go Microsoft Teams, or are you going to do something else? If it is Teams, then there's only three ways to do it, and the worst way is by just clicking the button and paying that expensive voice-enabling Teams button in your CSP's portal, or asking them to do it for you. Okay, so you're not 100% sold on Teams yet because your company has a unique group of end users. Good for you for caring. Then you may be wondering, and you need to answer all of these questions. Which platforms and interfaces have easy to self-manage portals, GUIs, so that you can make moves, ads, and changes on the fly? Which platforms are the most upgradable and have functioning APIs? Who will truly interoperate with your systems? Who's going to give you free equipment and headsets, of course, and be the most cost-effective? Who's going to support your team the best with fast technical support in minutes, not days? And who's going to meet your compliancy requirements now and in the future with flexible user licensing? How about network preparation, ensuring quality of service, and properly layering voice applications? How do you confidently ensure a smooth cutover and avoid going in with your fingers crossed? How do you negotiate all the legal ramifications of FCC regulated SLAs that affect your terms and conditions? Things like elasticity clauses and out of contracts if they fail to deliver. How do you know what your end users are thinking, and how to deal with explaining technical to people 1,000 times that don't know how to do a transfer? And even if you have all this down, what do you do if you have limited time to research, evaluate, and confidently plan a network communications upgrade that will surely impress your key stakeholders with return on investment, CapEx, OpEx, all of this stuff? Evaluate evaluate and where do you get started in an ocean of vendors? Which provider mix is going to best fit your company's culture versus just asking your peers who they use or shopping VoIP.com or Googling who's the best, and then you've got all kinds of people showing up in your inbox. This is why this is the classic put-off project where no one wants to take on the planning from start to finish, everything from auditing bills to surveying staff, researching providers, sifting through information, meeting with vendors, requesting proposals, ensuring all the effective transition without outages, and managing all of the negative Nancy naysayers who are surely going to complain about the new phone system. Let me and my special team of telecom nerds give you all of the rollout maps, RFP grids, and hold you by the hand for free, and even pit providers against them and give you all of the data information on what the lowest pricing has ever been with benchmark level pricing. Everything from seeing how far you can throw those old phone systems to every detail you need surrounding Microsoft Teams integrations or all of the best UCaaS providers with custom and in and out of the box APIs. Also, some of you are dealing with who's the best fit contact center software providers for your unique group of end users and agents and staff. How can you leverage AI software to drastically increase agent efficiency? And let's not forget about workforce management tools to ensure proper staffing, all while avoiding annoying meetings and sales reps telling you it's the end of the month, President's Day specials. All you need to do is email telecom@popularit.net and we will give you all of the information, everything you need, and hold you by the hand for free. And if you like the information, great, do whatever you want with it. And if not, you can tell us to go pound sand.
A couple things I'll just maybe I'll add some color or commentary on that you said. So first, you say it might not be the way for everybody to run things, but that's the joy of having so many different businesses out there, is that there's really are different. Each business has its own culture and its own lane and what works for it. So like one time when we talk about a business that, you know, has they get together and have, I'll call them, well, I'll say this somewhat facetiously, but feeling circles, you know, they get together, they'll talk about, let's talk about what's causing our problems today. Let's talk about, you know, these types of things and let's get it all out. That's not going to work for company B, you know, and that's fine. You know, their culture is just, it's different. So every organization has got its own way of doing things. You mentioned that you've done a lot of different things over the years of different leadership. There's a friend of mine who he was in the military, and he told me that when he goes, even the people that are, the way they teach leadership there is when they're even when they're swabbing the floors, they put two people in on the job because one's in charge at all points in time. And leadership doesn't start, like, even the smallest jobs, there's still a leader somewhere in some way. And you know, you'd mentioned that even at 17, you nominally or in factual application been in charge of somebody in various roles for a very long time. So there's a lot of experience. And then I think the other thing that I noted when you were talking about outside and inside the office, and I work in mid-sized enterprise myself. So your comments, I think, resonated with me, is the idea that the department is not large enough that we become somewhat anonymous. You know, like you can't just be like, hey, there's the guy who runs the place or the woman who runs the place, and then there's like a bunch of staff and they don't really communicate or talk to each other. We're small enough that we do. And you're going to end up talking and communicating outside of work. And, you know, there needs to be that like distinction to be like, hey, and particularly if you live in a smaller city or smaller town where you might just literally interact with these people because maybe we're on the same kids on the same little league teams and just other stuff like that. They go to the same school because we live in the same community. And you have to be able to make those distinctions survive isn't the right word, but to thrive in that environment, you have to be able to set aside like this is the work stuff and this is the outside the work stuff.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like I run I'm the president of my town's baseball and softball league. And the other day, one guy come up to me and goes, "You remember me?" And I'm like, "I'm sorry, sir, I don't." And he's like, "Well, I interviewed you with you back, you know, 10 years ago with that. And I didn't get the job and all that." I said, "Well, I hope I was nice." And he goes, "Well, yeah, you were very nice and all that and stuff. I just wanted to tell you, I remember that thing." I said, "Oh, you know, cool, great, you know." And, you know, that brings, you know, like, and just the more leadership thing is like, you know, like I have a baseball team and it's the same here too. You know, I teach the kids, I say, you know, play like you want to be the person. Yeah, even if you're in right field, you want to be the kid that somebody goes, "Man, who is that out there?" Because you know, the way you're playing. And just like in with your, if you're a coder in, you know, IT and stuff like that, you want somebody to say, "Who wrote that code? That is, you know, it's, it's succinct, it's neat, it's easy to understand. You know, it's not, if you know the language, it's easy to understand. But I mean, it's written in a way that somebody can come in and figure it out if they have a decent background. You want to be that person, you know.
So, but of course, nowadays, this is I'm gonna take a right turn here. AI is really good at writing code. Of all the things that AI is like, there's, you know, the we have a lot of conversations, and I use the we like in IT about the coming of AI tools and the change it's going to make and how, you know, oh God, it's going to replace these jobs, it's going to do this. And there's a lot of hyperbole about, you know, stuff that it claims will change, but is not really changing at this point. Maybe in the future it will. And that's that, you know, the future is the future. But like in today's environment, it's not replacing, you know, these jobs. But one thing that AI is, the current generation of AI seems to have been particularly well suited for, is becoming like a coding assistant for folks. And I don't know if you mentioned, because you've done some coding, so I'm just not sure where.
Yeah, I still, even though I'm in leadership, I try to do 50% or 75% coding still.
Mm-hmm.
I like, even though I don't do some of the newer languages as much anymore, I like to know what's going on. I like to know how, you know, that what looks good and what doesn't, and what works and what doesn't. And I, you know, I actually nowadays, you know, I don't use VS Code or anything like that. I use, right now I used VI for many years, and I've been using Vim. I used Vim, and now I'm going into Neo Vim, and it's got that Copilot now with Codeium. Mm-hmm. And you know, and some of the languages it'll suggest and stuff is like, it's getting better and stuff. But sometimes you ask the AIs to program something for you, and if you really know the language, you're like, yeah, that's not the best way to do something, but it may work. Then that's what I've been saying, is it, those coders like that, it's really the trainers and the data that the samples they have to work with. Like if, say, I'm not a big Python programmer. So if you trained a model on my Python scripts, you're not going to get as good a code as, you know, I say Guido, the guy who wrote Python. If you trained it on his scripts, you're going to get a lot better quality suggestions than if you do it on mine. You know, it's just, so you always got to take that for granted. You know,
I think we trained it on everybody's scripts. That's its own problem, is they go vacuum up everybody's work and then they use it to train the models, which, you know, it's like, you know, maybe we should all be compensated for that in some way. Right. But
exactly. Yeah.
You know, it's a whole different discussion there, but I think it's been one of the more, I don't say call it robust use cases, is that these AI tools are good partners for coders. Yeah. And so I'd be careful not to say like, hey, it's going to replace all these coders, because it isn't. Like, it makes mistakes. It doesn't logically figure certain things out. It requires review and it requires you to look over it. But relative to the effort it took to write the code, you can save yourself a bunch of time by getting something to start with and then work backwards from there, which a lot of times can be easier.
Oh yeah, that I will do. I've done that myself too. I'll do them, and then I'll say, oh yeah, I never thought of doing the syntax that way. And I'm like, yeah, okay, I'm gonna try to remember doing it that way. I'll take that. You know, it's kind of like when you use some of these tools, sometimes it almost seems like it will learn kind of how my traits of how I do it. I guess it's kind of getting kind of sophisticated in, okay, I do a lot of queries, and databases, and I like my stuff formatted this way, because I learned, you know, doing a lot of maintenance, like that's how I like to see queries written, so I can understand what it does and I can spot bugs real easy. And it seems like it's kind of picking that up and formatting it the way I like it, you know.
That's interesting.
So I do kind of for a little bit, it didn't work because my token wasn't right. I started doing it for a week and I'm like, I don't know if I'm going to do this. And I said, no, just push on and see what happens. And then I did. And so I got it, like started working 3 or 4 weeks with it. And then the token, you know, messed up and I'm like, hey, I'm not getting my suggestions anymore. And so then, you know, I went back and I fixed it just because I kind of missed it.
So, but I ask you to pontificate on the future a little bit here. But so, you know, using some of these tools, Where do you think some of this these AI tools are going, and where do you think it's going to be useful in our work here doing IT support and IT work?
I think it's going to be for us. We're looking at, you know, in my time here, it's going to hop, you know, it's going to make a lot more things a little more efficient. I'll make an example. When I first started here at Cassens, we had an 8 accounts payable department, and there were 7 ladies in there entering in invoices and such. Now we have 1.5 just because of EDI and stuff like that. And now I think with the AI, we're going to be able to cut that, not the people down, but it'll be because
you can grow the business with the same people, you know, become more efficient.
Because now, you know, we'll cut the you know, remaining paper out as much as we can, you know, because now we mostly only handle the things where we get somebody emails us a PDF for a bill, or they still do mail it to us, and then we scan it and we move it around. Now we'll be using things like DocUI and some of the other stuff like on Amazon also to, okay, I know I'm getting this PDF emailed to me, and I can lift the invoice number and I can lift this part out so somebody doesn't have to enter that and get the rest of, like I said, but doing EDI type things, we moved from 7 people to 1.5, and now we're going to move down to 1-ish and move it around and such. So where that one person that we won't get some of her time will be split, or his time, whoever is there, to another department to help something else out that, you know, we really, you know, be able to use our people even more efficiently, you know, and looking at trend, you know, instead of just banging out, getting stuff paid, now we'll be able to use those people to look at trends and see what we're doing right and what we're doing wrong with purchasing and stuff like that. That's where it's going to, you know, and some of that I can see AI even stepping in there where it might be able to help you that said, hey, you bought this widget last year for 50 cents and now it's 75 cents, where it might, or 3 years ago, you know, some kind of time where it'll say, where, you know, prices creep up on you, you don't even know it. And they might say, this is costing you 50% more, and the AI might actually go out and, you know, search the web for you and say, hey, you know, you're paying 75 cents, but this, you can get this for 60 cents from these people. You know, I could see it doing that kind of stuff where it kind of analyzes what you're buying and then goes out and gives you suggestions of, hey, you know, you might want to, you know, bid this out, you know, type of thing.
Well, if it can assume too much, right? You know, be like, oh, I bought this roll of duct tape and I brought this other thing. And then it's like, I'm sorry, Paul, it looks like you're planning a kidnapping.
That was scary too. You know, some of the stuff like, it's really amazing. You know, that kind of stuff is kind of scary. You know, you see it on, I'm sure, in your Google Maps and stuff like that, that, you know, I take a walk at lunch and I happen to walk by, you know, Taco Bell or something like that. And it's assuming that I went in there, you know, and how do you rate it? Or you get a Google survey, you know, sent to you saying, you know, did you go to this place today? Did you buy it with a credit card and all this different stuff? Just because their AI is put together that you went past a Taco Bell.
There's always, it's funny. So I was having a conversation with my older son yesterday about it was AI in cars, so self-driving cars. He's 10, and he was, let me think about how he framed this. If I recall correctly, his portion of the conversation was something like, you know, wow, is it like Tesla? Like, he was talking about Tesla, and he's like, I don't think we'd ever want to drive one of those. It's really dangerous. You know, nobody driving the car. And I'm like, well, how and of course these statistics are, there's some squishiness here in these statistics. So I'm not a Tesla fanboy by any measure. But there's a reasonable case that computer logic is probably better than humans at driving vehicles. You know, like there's probably, you know, the claims that there are less accidents if the computers were controlling the cars, that's probably accurate. The biggest challenge, though, comes with, to me, I see two big problems there. One, and that's what I explained to him. I said, there's two really big kind of like ethical or moral problems that you face. One is, how do you get the computer driving the car to be trained enough to know what's right and what's wrong? Because it, you know, we're people, so it's assumed that we're fallible and we make mistakes. And if I get into a car accident because I was talking to my son and not paying attention to the road for a moment, and I rear-ended a car, you know, that's, I'm obviously at fault, but that's considered like part of human failing. On the other hand, if a Waymo vehicle smashes into the back of a vehicle that's computer operated, suddenly it's a $1 million lawsuit, you know, because there's this assumption that the computer should have been infallible and that you right. let something onto the road that was not. But at the end of the day, how does these things have to learn? Like, we allow people to make mistakes that don't result, and I'm not talking about crash results of somebody dying or something like that, but I'm talking about like let's say the car, you know, bumps into somebody at 20 miles an hour at a red light and smashes up the back of the vehicle, but otherwise doesn't really injure anybody there. Now, if that car is like a Waymo car, they're probably on the hook for $1 million, or at least a lawsuit for $1 million, because somebody's like, oh, I know, that's deep pockets, and you let this technology out. So I'm explaining to him that the technology, the challenge with this technology that we have is, how do we get it knowledgeable enough, and at what point do we determine that it needs to learn? If that's, you know, like these large language models and stuff like that, they have to absorb data to learn new stuff. So you have to let it do something, and you also have to let it make manageable mistakes in right. order to understand what use cases or edge cases could happen, you know. And there's I think another example that I told him about, what could be problematic is the choice conundrum. So if I'm driving down the street and I'm going to rear end a car, or I'm going to go head on to another car, or I can swerve off the road, but I might hit a pedestrian, you know, what do I choose? You're going to hit somebody. Now, you and I would choose hitting the car, but how does a computer logic, is it going to know fast enough and make a determination that in a probability sense, it's wiser to hit the car than it is to mow down a pedestrian who's almost certainly going to get killed. You know, like those are real ethical quandaries that we face with technology today and how you roll it out.
Yeah, that is really going to be something, because, you know, when they get to that point, you know, they I know they've had, you know, cars that, you know, are self-driving and doing that. But from what everything I've read is that they're having problems with the AI interpreting what, like you said, that pedestrian, what they mean when they're standing along the road, like they're trying to wave you down or it's that's some of the problems they're having. And yeah, like, you know, your example is spot on. You know, it's like, do I go ahead and, you know, have the head on accident? Do I slam on the brakes and just hope that by doing something that might, me being still, that allows that other guy to do something? Mm-hmm. Or like I said, or do I just totally try to avoid it and, you know, and hit the pedestrian, you know,
that's yeah, something. In the car, the programming is probably going to have a bias for action, you know. So like you could actually, that's a, you brought up a great thing that just thought made me think about this. You said do nothing, so that is an option. So doing nothing is actually an option, and you and I may choose to do nothing because the alternatives are worse. But right. a computer program is unlikely to choose that because it'll have a bias towards action. Typically, it'll believe that it needs to pick something, and it may not identify that doing nothing is also picking something.
I brought out that do nothing because when I was in college, I was going down a country road, and I had a friend with me, and a car coming the other way was pulled out and passed that car and was flying, and we'd coming over the hill, and it was like, boom, what am I going to do? You mm-hmm. know? It's coming straight at us, and what I decided, stay in my lane, don't do nothing.
Mm.
And that car that was, you know, coming my going straight at me, it whipped itself into the ditch and went around us.
Oh wow!
So uh-huh. nothing happened.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a split. I remember thinking, you know, what should I do? Should I try to, you know, should I go into the ditch? Then I thought, he could be doing it. Just go straight, be predictable, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's what that person did. Whipped around us, and my friend was all upset and was like, You weren't even upset. I'm like, I didn't have time to be upset.
I was more upset than you thought, man.
Yeah. Don't check my underwear.
That's right. So yeah, I mentioned, like, when it comes to, like, an animal running in front of you, like a woodchuck runs across the road, yeah, whatever. A lot of people are like, oh my God, don't hit the woodchuck, and they swerve out of the way. I'm like, no, I will hit the brakes as long as it's reasonably safe and it won't cause another problem. I'm not going to swerve off the road and go potentially smash into a tree to avoid a woodchuck scurrying across the road, you know? So I'm sure I'll get some, you know, now I'll get hate mail from some animal rights activists, but.
Well, that was the example I was thinking about when you were talking about that was an animal, you know, it's like, mm-hmm, you know, they're going to have to program that in. If you're going down the road and you could, you know, you're looking forward like you're supposed to, and you're checking your rear view mirrors and everything else, and you see something run out in front of you and there's nothing out that you've checked everything, I'm going to swerve and miss it. If I see something coming, I think there's any chance that me trying to avoid it is going to make me lose control of the car, I'm going to hit it, you know.
That's right. Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing that they're going to have to get these things to do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes it has to make the choice to be like, so, you know, going back to the self-driving car and the programming, the ethical quandaries of this, like, you and I could make this rationalization and it's just accepted that as people we have, you know, we have the self-determination to make that rationalization and people accept that it was our right to make. But if you tell a car to do that, like, who ultimately gets to decide? And I'm not saying that like that we shouldn't decide, but there's a real question about who is the decider. And that's probably part of what we have to figure out in order to make this stuff work. Like, who gets to not be held accountable accountable isn't even the right word. But just to use the example, if I hit a car, I'm unlikely to be sued if nobody gets hurt. It's just an insurance claim. Everybody's cars get fixed. We go on our own way. It's frustrating. If a Waymo vehicle smashes in the back of another car, they're likely to get sued for a lot of money for not programming that car correctly. So at some point, we have to make a determination as a society, if you will, that it is acceptable for these vehicles to make a error that would be similar to the error that a human could make. And if we're going to put them in human conditions, we have to expect that there will sometimes be human failures, human-like failures that come from doing it.
And then how are these things going to be regulated? Because, you know, say these models are self-training. So you set the model up with accepted parameters of these decisions, and it somehow retrains itself and it starts deviates from the way you had it trained. How's that going to be regulated? You know, like, it's like, how, you know, cause we have tons of lawyers in the United States and mm-hmm. a bunch of, you know, a lot of everything's codified and law, you know, so how do you, if this AI is trained, is there going to be that you have to have these AIs be tested? You know, is it still conforming to what it was? Because, you know, these things are going to be certified and then put out there and then come back. Is it going to have to be checked later that it's still kind of like your brakes in your car? You got to check mm-hmm. them every once in a while to make sure that they're still good. Mm-hmm. You know, most of us, you know, a lot of us is when you start hearing the scraping and carrying on. But what about the AI? Is that going to be checked to say if it's still working within the confines of what it should be?
It's only when the AI goes, I'm sorry, Paul, I can't do that right now. and you're like, uh-oh, I think I've got a real problem here.
Because you think about it a little more, still is like every 3 or 5 years or whatever, like you got to go take a driver's test again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know,
absolutely. How do you recertify this stuff?
Recertify. So if you have a car and you drive it for 10 years at the halfway point, are you going to have to, or they don't have it, that you have to take it in and say that somewhere and says that they can check and say, yeah, your AI is up to specs. Mm-hmm. Otherwise it's like, no, your AI is not up to specs. You can't, we're not going to let you drive that, you know, well, I guess I could not say drive that vehicle, but sit in that vehicle while it drives you.
Yeah. So hey, I want to take us back to another topic. This is more of the fun topics. Not that we didn't have just a bunch of fun talking all about AI, car driving, self-driving vehicles and the ethics around them. So good thing we solved that problem for everybody. Yeah. If they just listen to the podcast, they got cliff notes on what to do.
Exactly. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about, oh yes, your history in computers. So like this is one of the things that we ask guests a lot, to just get a feel for the era of computing that you came of age in and where you were. So what was your first computer and your first big technology experience?
The first computer that I got to use was my brother's, back in the 70s or early 80s, bought a TRS-80.
Oh, a TRS-80. Nice.
We used to call it a trash 80. You know.
Yeah. Oh, but yeah. Yeah.
They were actually pretty good machines, except their floppies would deteriorate really fast.
Hmm.
And it ran, ran basic and such like that. So that was my first. And my brother's always liked, my older brother that bought it, always liked stocks and stuff like that. So he bought it to crunch numbers for buying stocks and stuff like that. So
in the early 80s, he was using this to crunch stock numbers.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
He would go to me, when I was in high school, they had the Apple IIs, and you had the little mm-hmm. programs that you would write that make it, make a little box and swirl back and forth with the box and stuff like that. So I knew a little bit about Apple basic. So then he wanted me to work on his machine and, learn that basic, and doing things like, can you draw this chart and stuff like that of a stock? Mm-hmm. Okay, and sat around trying to get it and banging my head against the wall and stuff like that. And then one night I was watching Doctor Who, and it used to be on TV on PBS at 10 o'clock on a Sunday night. And I'm sitting there watching Doctor Who. It was just mindless drivel. I hope I don't offend anybody, because I would just watch it. And all of a sudden I'm just watching it. I'm like, that's how you do it. About how to chart these stocks. And I ran back and got a piece of paper, because I didn't, the computer was at his house, and just write it all down, the code. And then I was excited. The next day I went over there and coded it all up. And sure enough, I had a nice, a nice chart with a line, representing the stock close price on there, and going, I can do this. And
to PBS, your public dollars at work here.
Public dollars. Like I said, it was one of those things where you'd watch the show and your mind would just release, going, mm-hmm. And then I've always found that sometimes you just got to let your mind release, and the answer will come to you
in the shower.
My people here at work always laughing if I come in and I say, I was in the shower this morning, and I was thinking, oh God, what does he come up with now? In that inspiration type moment like that. So yeah, that was like my first using, computers and stuff. And then when I was in college, I have a master's degree, joint master's of science in economics and mathematics.
Oh.
And I was doing independent study on doing some Box Jenkins analysis of stock prices again. There's a theme here. Mm-hmm. And back then you couldn't use spreadsheets or anything like that, because the decimal places didn't go out far enough. So I was writing Fortran to do it. I had to pick up how to do Fortran, and was doing it that way. And that was kind of neat. So I got a little experience. I ran all my information and stuff like that, and, kind of got into it. I was in economics and mathematics, so I wasn't like a programmer or anything. Mm-hmm. And then I got a job, and I was in the government. And this is like before the first Gulf War. I was going to get RIF, which is reduction in force. Mm-hmm. And we were looking through the job openings and stuff. And back in the early 90s, the job market wasn't like it is now. It was sparse, And I saw this ad asking for somebody which knew Informix 4GL was the language back then. And I grabbed a book and I looked at it and I opened it up and I read through the book. And I go, yeah, I can do that. So I
make it stay naked here.
responded to it and had the interview, got the job, read the book three times and started programming. And kind of that was the change in my career, back then was, yeah, I can do that. And went down that line. I really liked it because, I don't know, it's a lot of programming and some of the things I do is really math based. Mm-hmm. So I had a really good structure for it, I feel. And, I've always kind of liked that, because for the most part, you know, math is black and white. You know, a lot of problems that we deal with in programming, there's an answer to. It's just if you can find it. There's some that you'll never find, but it's just, you know, that's just, I just kind of fell into it. You know, and for my master's degree, like I said, I have two master's degrees. For my mathematics, it's stat OR. And for my master's thesis, I had to write, again, some Fortran programs to do these calculations of these average run length distributions, and just kind of liked it, you know, and and just kind of fell into it, you know.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's a great story. Like in the 80s, you were writing stock chart programs. Like that's, yeah, that's pretty fancy right there. That's a great story. Yeah. So we're coming up to the end of our episode here. And before we go, I want to ask you, for our listeners, especially the ones, you know, you've been in a long career here in one spot, which is really awesome and unique in its own ways. What advice would you share for somebody who is coming into the business today in IT and IT leadership? What would you give them as advice? Sorry, I put you on the spot for a second here, right?
Patience and adaptability. You know, a lot of the things what we did back 30 years ago, I wouldn't do it today. Some of it we still use and it's still working, but man, it's going to be in the future here. You're going to have to be this, understand that a lot of projects will really never really be done with the use of like toolkits like Angular and things like that, where you create a progressive web app. Man, you'll get the more sophisticated it is, it takes a little longer to take you a year to create this thing or a year and a half. You get that thing and you get it deployed. You got to turn your team around and have them upgrade it. Because over that time, now you're two versions of Angular behind. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have your team constantly touching that code and such, and if you don't touch it like for a year or a year and a half, it gets so far behind, and then they don't remember the crucial things that it takes to upgrade it. So it's like, it's the time of having a green screen app, a program that, yeah, I wrote that 10 years ago and you don't touch it ever since, it's gone. I mean, you're going to, more and more, you got to deploy these apps, have your teams constantly in that app, just so when Angular says, you know, this method or something like that's going away, they understand what's going on so they can replace it and keep the thing running. Because otherwise you're going to have to, what's happening then is you got to try to, and then you have to have all these Docker boxes and everything else that you can run and keep it at an operating system that's, you know, 2 or 3 years old, running older versions just so you can keep running it. Otherwise, if you want to keep running on the newest cell phones and everything else, as soon as you deploy something, you got to get in there and just keep it on a development cycle and keep on there. And because, like I said, the times of these, I wrote this program 20 years ago and they use it every day, is gone.
You're not picking up your code from 1992. Yeah. All right. Paul, thank you so much for investing your time with us on the podcast today.
Yeah, no problem. Great to talk to you.
That's a wrap on today's episode of Dissecting Popular IT Nerds. I'm Doug Kameen, and we look forward to coming to you on our next episode.